You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon, and thank you to the Carnegie Endowment. I am Marina Ottaway, the director of the Middle East program here. I am particularly pleased with this meeting because we are venturing in an area which is very important and which we have not covered earlier in the Middle East program. That is the entire issue of security sector reform. It's certainly an issue of great importance, and the only reason why we never did anything about it before, it's just a question, per usual, of time and manpower, resources, and so on. So we were extremely happy when Yazid Saeed, 18 months ago, something like that, came to the Carnegie Middle East Center, or went to the Carnegie Middle East Center, and spent time there as a visiting fellow, as he was working on a larger project, I think, on security sector reforms in a number of Arab countries. The outcome of that stay with the Carnegie Endowment is this paper. He is professor of Middle Eastern studies at the Department of War Studies at King's College in London, and we are very lucky that this year he is here in this country at Cambridge, and therefore he was able to come down and discuss the issue with us. To my right is Nicole Ball, who is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C., and a senior visiting fellow at the Conflict Research Unit of the Klingendahl Institute in The Hague. And she has worked for many years on issues of security sector reform. I cannot think of anybody else in town who has done more work on issues of security sector reform than Nicole has. With all due respect with Jim, I think Nicole has done more work. Jim Zanotti is an analyst in the Middle Eastern Affairs at the Congressional Research Center, and his focus is he has authored and co-authored reports on U.S. security assistance and foreign aid to the Palestinians, or the report on 2008-09 Israel-Hamas conflict in Gaza and prospects for a two-state solution. So I think he'll be speaking more to the Palestinian side of the issue. Without further ado, because we have three speakers and not much time, please, Yazid.
Thank you very much for the introduction, Marina. It's a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank you all for being here as well. It is, in fact, striking just how little analysts, academics, others working on and in the region look at the security sector in a very broadly defined, i.e. the men with guns, basically, whether they're policemen, intelligence officers, regular army, other state-sponsored bodies and agencies of coercion. I've read entire books that discuss authoritarianism in the Middle East, and yet you will not find one single reference to the military, which is an extraordinary thing, because how is authoritarianism constructed without the role of the military, and certainly in the Middle East? That's sort of by way of very broad backdrop. What I intend to do today, since obviously I also have limited time and I would very much like to hear your comments, is to speak to the paper really rather than to try and summarize it, partly because it's online and it's easily accessible to you, and my two colleagues will of course be referring to what they read, I assume, rather than to what I'm about to say, so I thought I'd diversify a little. And I want to start first by giving you a sense of where this started. And it started for me in 2005 as the main donors, I refer to them as donors, the United States, the European Union, and others, tried to relaunch peacemaking in Israel and Palestine in the wake of the Israeli disengagement from Gaza. And part of that process involved rehabilitating Palestinian security services. This was something that had now become possible in the wake of the death of Yasser Arafat and the election of Mahmoud Abbas as his successor as the president or chairman of the Palestinian Authority. So suddenly, restructuring or rebuilding, reforming the security sector was in again. And here's what struck me at the time, that it became very in. In other words, it became a sexy thing to do. Everyone wanted to do it all of a sudden after years of negligence. So we moved from a situation in which there was a serious lack of any attention to rebuilding the security sector, let alone reforming it. And by reform, I specifically mean the professionalization of the security sector and bringing it under clear civilian control, democratically elected, accountable, transparent governance, etc. All the sort of buzzwords we hear that we seek in development practice generally. So we moved in 2005 from a situation of lack of any serious concern or discourse about security sector reform to, late in the year, a situation in which everyone, as I said, wanted to jump on the boat. In my personal experience, one instance that happened was an attempt to set up a workshop in Jericho to, well, no one really knew what to do, except that the Canadians, who at that time wanted to improve relations with the Bush administration, said, we want to do something, so someone came up with the idea of a workshop. It took quite a long while to decide what the workshop was about, what it was for, and I know this because I was one of the people with whom a lot of emails were exchanged, both by the people trying to set up the workshop and find a purpose for it, and by a variety of academic departments, private companies, NGOs, all of whom wanted to bid for the new contracts that were now starting to be put out. So it gives you a sense of the sort of dynamics that drive this process. I should add what followed after the election of Hamas, just two or three months later, the victory of Hamas in the general elections of 25 January 2006, was that suddenly again something bizarre happened. Since the quartet parties, especially the US and the EU, would no longer operate with a Hamas government so long as it hadn't accepted the principles for dialogue, recognizing Israel, renouncing violence, and accepting past treaties or agreements that had been signed, we had the situation in which the people who'd won the contract to do security sector reform in Palestine had rented office space in Jerusalem, had sent someone there to do the job, and then they were told, yes, but you can't talk to the government. How you reform a security sector without talking to a government is beyond me, but the answer was, well, maybe if we talk to local NGOs and civil society and we can come up with innovative ideas. And one of the people who repeated this was Lieutenant General Keith Dayton, who remains the United States Security Coordinator in Palestine, and who, speaking to Congress in March 2006, presented this particular idea as an option. Now, it's good to think innovatively, but it gives you a sense of how the whole issue of security sector reform and restructuring has been approached. There is clearly a political incentive. I mean, that's clear, and it's not a wrong one. But it has operated in dysfunctional ways, as I'll start to explain in a couple of moments. First, I just want to give two more quick little examples of how these dynamics work. One is that, again, because there are so many actors out there that are keen to demonstrate visibly their commitment to the process, the substance tends to get overlooked or blurred. A very good example of this was the attempt by German Chancellor Angela Merkel to do something, to be seen to do something. In Lebanon, one initiative was for Germany to take the lead in establishing a capable Lebanese border force to prevent smuggling across the borders. And the Germans took that on until it became evident that it was actually rather too big a task, and they started to look around for people to help them with it. In Palestine, what happened in 2007, the second half of 2007, after Hamas took over Gaza, and suddenly, again, security sector reform was back on the agenda, this time far more seriously, it must be said. The Germans wanted to find something to do. Merkel wanted to find something to do and wanted to set up a peace conference. But that had been taken. Bush was already coming up with the plan for a conference in Annapolis. So she shopped around, and there were various ideas exchanged between the Germans and the Palestinians until finally Germany said that they were going to hold a conference for support of police, civilian police, and the justice system in Palestine, which was, in fact, held in Berlin in June 2008. Again, not wrong or bad in and of itself, but indicative of the lack of an actual policy or an actual strategy. And time and again, one little example I'm very fond of is that many donor states, smaller ones in particular, have a particular fondness for donating cars, vehicles, because it's easy, because often it can be done to encourage your own local industry in Japan or in part of Europe or in Spain or wherever else. So you donate cars. And you end up with the poor Lebanese police force or the Palestinian police force or the Yemeni or others with a very mixed car pool, which means you have to keep many more spare parts, you have to acquire many more mechanical skills, costs of inventories go up, et cetera, et cetera. You can imagine. Now, what I've described so far is not at all unique to security sector reform and donor behavior in it. This is what donors tend to do in all areas of aid and development, whether it's helping healthcare or helping anything else. Now, this is where I started with the project. Once I'd actually done the field work, or more field work than I'd done previously, last year, based in Beirut, as Marina mentioned, I came to a somewhat different conclusion that rather than focus on the sort of the flawed developmental practice, that actually the technical aspect was not the most important. Rather, what I concluded was that the United States and the European Union, the two actors I was focusing on, we're basically prioritizing counterterrorism. Now, I should explain a little bit about this. Counterterrorism in and of itself is legitimate. There are terrorist threats there as elsewhere. Local states do need a capability to deal with the threat. My point, however, is that the idea of reform in the sense of strengthening rule of law, an accountable, democratically elected government which exercises effective civilian oversight over security sector, these key values that distinguish reform from traditional Cold War-style security assistance continue to be noticeably absent in most of the Middle East, where the US and the EU are involved. The EU tends to talk the talk far more. There are explicit references in almost every partnership arrangement or association agreement that the EU signs with local counterparts about rule of law and about democratic development. But when you look at the security sector, 90% of what happens is what has always happened. We train and equip other people to do certain jobs, hopefully well and professionally. Far less effort, whether political effort or technical effort and financing, goes into the broader and more intangible aspects of rule of law and criminal justice reform and so on. Now, I want to emphasize that, of course, we're talking, in my case, I'm talking about Palestine, Lebanon, and Yemen, each of which have fractured states, have come out of conflict, are quasi-democratic, but not, you know, unambiguously democratic systems, divided societies, polarized politics, and no real consensus on what security is, what it's about, who it's for, or how to conduct it. Rather, because of a legacy of conflict and violence, which in all three cases is not yet gone, the tendency to militaristic responses and authoritarian responses is still very strong. The culture is deep and is rooted in the power structures of these places. Now, this poses a number of challenges for outside actors who want to do good. Can they, in fact, get involved in restructuring security sectors, which, after all, are extremely important, prized assets in any power struggle? Do you get in there and take the risk that you're going to end up supporting one side against another, whether you intend to or not? Look at Palestine. We now have two rival governments in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. One of the contributory factors to that was the decision by the United States administration after the election of Hamas, not simply to isolate or to not to talk to Hamas, but to bring the Hamas government down. And one of the tools it used was to arm what it saw as the rivals in those branches of the police forces that were governed or controlled by Hamas's rivals, Fatah and President Abbas. Now, in effect, in Palestine, this helped accelerate military solutions. It helped accelerate the polarization and militarization of politics and ultimately contributed to the breakdown, the total breakdown of constitutional order. We now have two rival governments, each of which rests on dubious constitutional grounds or legitimacy in Gaza and the West Bank, each with its own entire setup of police services, from the civilian police to the intelligence to its sort of police support units or semi-army units. That's to give the most graphic example. Now, Part of the answer of the EU and the US has been in places like Lebanon and Yemen, which in which their involvement is far more modest than in Palestine. But in Palestine, too, the approach encapsulated by Colin Smith, the former head of the EU Civilian Police Mission, quoting from the former commissioner of police in New York, Bratton, that we fix windows, fix broken windows, we fix what we can. The idea is, if you can't deal with everything in one go, pick on a few small things, get them right, you create a conducive environment for other things to go right, and then you pave the way for wider, real reform. Now, leaving aside the fact that the US generally doesn't use a reform discourse at all in any of these places, but it's become far more tolerant, in my view, as a result of the Iraqi experience in particular, to the need for institution building and to build up central institutions such as ministries of interior, although it tends to leave these roles to its EU partners. My point simply is to say that the fixing broken windows approach does have a lot to commend it. It's not illogical. After all, donors can't do everything. Things take time. And certainly it is good if you can construct a more conducive environment in order to help pave the way for later reforms. However, in my assessment, why this is not working and is not entirely convincing is that fixing broken windows might work if it was part of a clear, wider reform for the whole sector. Then it makes sense in consultation and agreement with local counterparts, whether in government, security commanders, civil society, the parliament, etc., to identify priorities by mutual agreement, and then to focus on those with an understanding of where to go next and how these link up to each other. The priorities then might be different than the priorities we see actually pursued in Yemen or Lebanon or Palestine by the US and the EU. So that's one main point. And the other is that in the absence of a major political and financial commitment to supporting more large-scale reforms in local security sectors, what's happening is that this fixing broken windows approach is actually creating a situation of sort of drift. In Lebanon, for instance, the US and the EU accept or believe that because the security sector is so captured by rival communal confessional agendas and claims, it's impossible to conduct sector-wide reform. So they don't try at all. They just do little bits and pieces where they can. Now, the problem is that in all three cases, the one bit of the agenda that is actively pursued and purposefully pursued is the counterterrorism agenda. In each of these three cases, counterterrorism units, those intelligence agencies that are seen by the outside donors as the most likely candidates for support to be effective in this role, are in fact supported to the exclusion of the rest of the sector. So you end up with uneven development within security sectors. You, at best, develop enclave agencies here and there, which are better trained, more professional, do their jobs well. Unfortunately, even this can have a negative consequence, which is that the more that is invested in an agency and the more it becomes high and prestigious, a high-profile agency, the more actually it becomes an asset desired by other power contenders within the local system who all want to capture it or have one like it. So we without a broader approach to security sector reform, the current one is, in effect, producing further dysfunctional consequences in local security sectors. Now, I'll wrap up as quickly as I can by saying, let's flip this around the other way. I mean, clearly, it's very hard for any outside actor with the best intention in the world and even with a great plan to change local realities. The security sector is part of local power structures and relations. Shifting it in any way will upset someone and benefit someone else. There's no way of doing it with neutral impact. So what do you do? Do you throw more money at it? Is that the problem? Because again, if we look at these three cases, we'll see that the amount of investment, of financial investment, bluntly, by the US and the EU in these three cases is very modest. Certainly in Lebanon and Yemen, and it's extremely modest, and in Palestine, far less is delivered than is pledged. So is the answer then, you know, don't go in unless you're willing to go in with a lot more backup. Now, This is not so easy, partly because these same actors are seriously overstretched with their international commitments, certainly in Iraq and Afghanistan, definitely, but also elsewhere, from Sierra Leone to other parts of the world. So it's not so easy. It really is not that easy. But I also want to emphasize, and these are my closing two points, two examples, two experiences that I think are very instructive here. One is that out of the three cases I've looked at, the one where the most progress has been achieved is Palestine, specifically since June 2007, where the new prime minister, Salam Fayyad, was very determined to bring down security sector numbers, and he succeeded within 1 year of bringing down the number from 90,000 to around 60,000 personnel. In other words, he reversed a decade of what Arafat had done of giving jobs to the boys in Fatah as a means of patronage and co-opting and reducing unemployment, etc. Fayyad, within a year, managed to reverse the situation with almost no real protest. And that's quite extraordinary. That was thanks to his determination, his technical, professional capability, I mean, the fact that he understands how to do things in management and financial management and so on. The fact that for once there was a president who was willing to back him up and a minister of interior who was also willing to work along as well. So, in other words, there was local ownership of the process. Fayyad prioritized. He determined what he needed most. It worked. And to the extent that the US and the EU have been producing results, this has been because there have been local security commanders and ministers and so on who've really wanted to do certain things, and they've worked out for themselves what they wanted. Every time the US or the EU have gone along to Fayyad or the Minister of Interior or others and said, why don't you have this? What about that? Wouldn't you like to have the following? These guys sit there and say, well, if you want to throw it at us and give it to us, okay, we'll put it somewhere. But they don't use these nice little offices and assessment units and planning units because they don't yet haven't internalized just what they want them for. And finally, the one case that I originally was going to put into this paper and finally couldn't for reasons of space was Jordan. Jordan for me was like the control case, the one out of the four countries where there was no donor-sponsored or donor-initiated security sector reform process. Jordan is in total sovereign control of over its security forces, and it has very professional security forces. Not necessarily democratically controlled and accountable, mind you, but very professional. And what I found immensely striking and interesting was that in Jordan, the Jordanian leadership, as every security commander will tell you when you ask them to explain just how come you are so able to change, to be up with the times, to modify, consolidate, reorganize your security sector and professionalize it. You introduce new ideas like community policing, police kiosks in busy streets, all these new ideas. Jordan does them. Not Lebanon, let's say, where there's a very free press and much more pluralism, not Palestine, where there's been much more donor support in Jordan. They always, of course, will start by saying, well, it's thanks to the gracious wisdom of our Hashemite monarchy, which is not entirely stupid because stability and direction are important. My point simply is to say that there are cases out there. Jordan is a very good case of a country where they have been keeping up, let's say, with the science of security management, at least, and are doing it for themselves. They are part of a close relationship with the US and with the West generally, economically, strategically, and so on, so it makes it easier. They're very conscious of what looks good, and they want to look good, and so they buzz all the right buttons. But I found it fascinating that they've understood and accepted or decided for themselves that it works to press buttons. Let's talk about democracy and citizens and so on. Every security officer I spoke to emphasized those things first and foremost. Now, whether they're sincere or not, they do actually follow up in terms of delivery to a very high degree. And I just find it fascinating that this is all done without one iota of the US or the EU coming along and saying, we don't like your human rights record, you'd better start doing the following. What they do because they've worked it out for themselves, whether ultimately this is democratic security or not. And I just wanted to end there, really leaving that question hanging in the air of, can donors actually transform anything unless the local actors really want it? My argument briefly would be no amount of external coercion or bribery will work unless there is local ownership. A great example is Yemen, where things have been pushed on the Yemeni president that he doesn't want, and he just refuses them. The fact that he stands to gain or win a lot from the West hasn't shifted his or his security commander's willingness to cooperate or not to cooperate. So it's not been bribery, it's not been the withholding of bribery. And in short, I think that the West, the EU, and the US can't do much in the absence of local ownership. If there is local ownership, then they do need to invest the resources. That's no guarantee it'll all work, but that's the only occasion when it might. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Yazid. Certainly a lot of food for thought and a lot of food for discussion, and I think...
Thank you, Marina, and thanks very much to the Carnegie Endowment also for asking me to take part in this panel. And I'd like to thank Yazid for producing what is a very interesting and informative paper, which I have had the opportunity to read. As Yazid knows, I dip in and out of Middle Eastern affairs, and therefore I really appreciated the opportunity to read his paper and learn a bit more about what has happened in the last year or so, particularly in Palestine and Lebanon, since I dipped in there. I think in terms of substance, I mean, sorry, in terms of comments. In terms of substance, I really don't think that there's a word in the paper that I disagree with. I really found that I agreed with just about everything there. So my comments really are in the nature of observations about the U.S. approach to security sector reform. And in that regard, my first comment is that the United States doesn't have an approach to security sector reform. So Yazid, it's not surprising if they're not doing it. This isn't a trivial point, because in his conclusion, Yazid says that the United States and the European Union have a significant role to play in encouraging and assisting security sector reform and restructuring in Palestine, Lebanon, and Yemen. So if they have that significant role, it seems essential to me that they actually understand what security sector reform is all about and have a clear approach to promoting it. Now, what the U.S. does have as far as security sector reform is concerned is a very few, very, very few, but very dedicated officials in the State Department, in DOD, and in USAID who have been attempting to educate their superiors for the last couple of years. And what they've done is they've produced a nice series of guidelines for planning and implementing security sector reform that were published earlier this year. And I recently learned that two deputy assistant secretaries, one in DOD and one in state, went to a meeting at Wilton Park in the UK a couple of months ago in September and actually mentioned that they thought this was a good thing. So this is good news. I mean, this is, if you have a look at this, this is somewhere on the web, I think. You'll see that it fits very much with the notion of security sector reform that Yazid has outlined. And also, I mean, we have it in various sort of documents. You know, security sector reform was mentioned in the State Aid Development Strategic Plan for 2007-2012. It's in the Foreign Assistance Framework and so on and so forth. Interestingly, and Yazid mentions this in his paper, there's a whole chapter on security sector reform in the Army Field Manual on Stability Operations. Now, it's very interesting because this chapter was pretty much extracted from the OECD Development Assistance Committee Handbook on Security Sector Reform, which many people consider to be the state of art as far as conceptualizing security sector reform is concerned. And I know that they were in contact with the Development Assistance Committee while they were producing that. But having this is really a very long way from having a well-thought-out approach to security sector reform that is accepted within the government as a whole and is implemented by the government as a whole. So the question for me really is, how do we shorten the distance between where we are now and where it would be good to go? How do we make progress on educating the U.S. government on some of the issues that Yazid raises in his paper? My second observation relates to the emphasis in U.S. policy, which Yazid has just mentioned, on counterterrorism, while, as he points out in his paper, espousing democratic development and rule of law as key objectives of U.S. policy. Now, it's not at all uncommon, as we all know, for governments to have multiple objectives right? And institutions reflect those multiple objectives, so it's not surprising if state aid and DOD and others have different objectives. The challenge, of course, is in reconciling those different objectives. And in this case, reconciling them in a manner that's consistent with promoting accountability and adherence to the rule of law in the security sector in countries that receive assistance from the United States. In countries like the UK and the Netherlands, which are the two countries which are arguably most advanced in terms of promoting security sector reform, and I have to say that doesn't say a whole lot, but nonetheless, they are at the forefront. It has proven very difficult in the post-9/11 world, actually, to balance an accountability rule of law approach to the security sector and security sector reform with the demands of counterterrorism and the counterterrorism approach to security, which Yazid describes very nicely in the case of the three countries he looks at. And the only reason there's really been any success in UK and Netherlands is because the bulk of what the U.S. calls foreign assistance is actually, it resides in those two countries with the development assistance agencies. The money is with the development assistance agencies. And that makes a world of difference. I mean, it's very hard to explain to Europeans sometimes the difference, but I think that it's very important to understand that because I think the fact that DOD has most of the money just tells the whole story. So the question for me here is, if you, given the overwhelming focus, overwhelming CT focus in U.S. military and foreign policy, is there any way that the U.S. government can be convinced that their counterterrorism objectives will be promoted by what Yazid describes as a comprehensive and deliberately transformative approach to security sectors and associated criminal justice systems? In other words, a really a serious approach aimed at enhancing accountability and democratic governance in that sector. Can the U.S. ever believe that the security of the U.S., because that's obviously what they're primarily interested in, that the security of the U.S. will be safeguarded when the countries whose security we think is important to our security, have democratically governed security bodies and effective and accessible justice systems, and more importantly, that the security of this country will be jeopardized by the lack of democratically governed security bodies and effective and accountable and accessible justice systems in those countries that we think are strategically important. I mean, you know, I'm old enough to remember a lot of the history of the post-war period, and I have to say that I'm not optimistic. Related to this is my third observation, which is that Yazid's paper demonstrates that a business-as-usual approach where counterterrorism objectives reign supreme can be counterproductive in terms of achieving even the desired counterterrorism objectives, and Yazid has just talked about that a little bit. I mean, I think these days, if we think about the word Pakistan, that should be fairly evident. But there obviously are other places where this is a big issue. And Yazid points out, and as he's mentioned, that this approach can produce negative competition amongst rival agencies in search of material and other resources. Simply by saying we are doing counterterrorism. And we see that not only in the three countries that that Yazid has talked about, but indeed in lots of other places in the world, unfortunately. And Yazid said that this ultimately reinforces stovepiping and the concentration of executive power. Now, in the case of Lebanon, the problems associated with stovepiping in his report are very nicely illustrated because he just mentioned that the three main intelligence agencies don't share information, you know, and they don't process, analyze, and act on the information they have. Now, that's not what I would like to have in terms of a counterterrorism partner. I would like to have something somewhat different, but it's not a surprising outcome in the circumstances. So we really have to ask what it is we're getting when we invest in this way. And my final observation relates to the lessons that Yazid draws at the end of his paper, which he didn't really talk about here, but I'll mention a couple of them. And particularly I'm interested in, first of all, the need for reconciliation and consensus building among domestic actors in Lebanon, Palestine, and Yemen. In other words, that the U.S. and the EU should support that. And secondly, that the U.S. and the EU should support should not at all make assistance conditional on exclusionary policies toward local opposition. We're thinking of Hamas here, for example. I mean, but we can think of others as well. And thirdly, the need to engage all stakeholders in discussions about reform and in the process of reform and transformation itself. Now, I started by saying that I agreed with every word that Yazid had written, and I do. And I agree in particular with those as important lessons to take away. But I do have two concerns. As I said, the first, is that the U.S. has shown virtually no interest in this approach, in learning these kinds of lessons since the 1950s when we got into the foreign assistance business. It's pretty consistent history that we have. And the second concern is that from a policy perspective, while this report analyzes the problems confronting U.S. policy in terms of promoting security sector reform really well, and we've just, Yazid has just given us more in that vein, it doesn't really help us take the critical steps toward figuring out how, after all these years of manifestly flawed approaches to security assistance, the U.S. can truly learn the lessons that Yazid lays out in this report and other lessons that we can think of and begin to actually change its behavior in the way that Yazid would like to see. But, Marina, perhaps there can be a sequel to deal with these issues, and I, for one, would be really happy to read that myself. So thank you, Yazid, very much for a very good piece of work.
To be continued.
I too am pleased to be here today again. Thank Yazid and Marina and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace having me along with these distinguished speakers and being involved in this discussion. I'd like to preface my remarks by saying that although I work for the Congressional Research Service, my comments today are entirely my own and do not reflect the views of the Congressional Research Service or of anyone in Congress. When Yazid was bringing up the June 2008 Berlin conference, it got me to reflect upon the fact that I was actually in Berlin in June of 2008 finishing up a postgrad fellowship and following the conference on Palestinian security. Little did I know that 3 months later, I would begin an in-depth research project on that very topic, the Palestinian Security Forces, for Congress, and that a year later, I would be presenting on the very day that Chancellor Merkel is addressing a joint session of Congress. So I'm not insinuating that Chancellor Merkel is following me around or anything like that, but I found that I'm not too worried. Well, I also want to congratulate Yazid on the paper. There's not been much light thrown on situations in the Middle East in which the U.S. and Europe are trying to aid security without the direct involvement of their own troops. The fact that these situations don't attract the limelight as readily as those in which Western troops are deployed makes it all the more noteworthy when a serious analysis such as Yazid's is published. I'd like to begin by taking a little bit of inventory of what I see as Yazid's key points, and then perhaps fast forward to some of the challenges that I see as someone who deals with U.S. policymakers on a day-to-day basis of how to get policymakers to potentially to listen to what he has to say. Writing a comparative account of multiple Western-aided SSR efforts, it can be very helpful in the sense that it identifies certain needs, certain trends that cut across the region, and ask whether certain first principles of the Western approach to security reform assistance either could be emphasized, rethought, or perhaps even scrapped altogether. At the same time, Yazid's taken care to give proper attention to the specific factors of each situation. Differences clearly exist among the three cases that demand contextualized approaches to security and political reform. Yemen features a tightly controlled central government that faces challenges from its recent history as a divided nation, as well as a variety of tribal, Islamist, and separatist factions. Lebanon, by contrast, has a barely functioning government featuring a minority participant, Hezbollah, that controls key swaths of territory and border regions and has proven itself adept at stalemating the system with its independent capacity for violence. Of the three, the Palestinian situation may be the biggest outlier. First of all, to state the obvious, there is no Palestinian state. What the Palestinians do have, which Yazid mentioned, is divided rule in two non-contiguous territories. You have the Palestinian Authority, ruled by Mahmoud Abbas, in the West Bank, and you have a version of the Palestinian Authority that Hamas holds up as the legitimate one in Gaza. And the situation is further complicated by ongoing Israeli control over much of the West Bank and Israeli/Egyptian control over access to the Gaza Strip. The differences between Hamas and Hezbollah, their ideologies, the societies and political cultures in which they operate, their access to weapons and resources, may very well outweigh their similarities as hybrid political military groups with an anti-Israel orientation. In his paper, Yazid enumerates five crucial lessons in his conclusion section, but to me, they can be further distilled into two main points, the first of which is that he believes that the U.S. and the EU should encourage rather than discourage, and Nicole got into this as well, the involvement of all key stakeholders, including domestic opposition movements, in political consensus building to give greater legitimacy to security sector reform efforts. And the second key point that I was able to distill from Yazid's conclusions were that he believes that security sector reform, as he just said as well, cannot be handled purely as a matter of, as the title of the report says, fixing broken windows. Although building operational capacity is important, the paper says it should go hand in hand with an integrated system of policy and decision-making and democratic oversight, largely for the reason that, in Yazid's own words, there is no such thing as impact-neutral security assistance. Even technical training alters domestic power balances and distorts incentive structures. Now, these conclusions don't offer a point-by-point prescription for policymakers in each particular situation, but rather a basic conceptual framework for them to apply. By framing the debate, the paper prompts questions such as the following. How can consensus with key stakeholders and domestic opposition groups be built? What are the timing and mechanics that should be adopted to foster inclusion? Should there be negotiated arrangements, popular elections? To what extent should the U.S. and the EU be involved in advising and brokering deals among the various stakeholders? And in this regard, I think that Yazid's postscript about the Jordanian situation is quite interesting, because there you have a situation where there isn't direct U.S. And EU involvement on conditions and on priorities. The Jordanians have figured it out for themselves. In addition, to what extent might greater inclusivity of opposition groups undermine those very actors, such as the PA's Mahmoud Abbas, who've defined their political future in reliance on the continuation of Western support and follow-through? Should the U.S. and EU attach conditions before lending their support, Nicole spoke to that, to the inclusion of armed groups in a political process? If so, can you enforce those conditions? For example, if there's support or acquiescence to the inclusion of Hamas in a PA power-sharing arrangement, which is talked about, what steps can and should they take to prevent Hamas from becoming another Hezbollah that is able to veto future PA political decisions through force? By tracing the historical arc of each case as he treats it, Yazid seems to be trying to drive home to policymakers the broader argument that short-term counterterrorism should be supported by long-term political strategies. In that light, the paper seeks to expand the focus of future deliberations on security assistance options, both in terms of time horizons being used and also in terms of evaluating how security assistance affects political outcomes. As someone who directly deals with policymakers, again, I wanted to address some of the challenges that I see in taking what Yazid has offered and the prospects that policymakers would actually adopt some of these suggestions. The first challenge, oddly enough, is success. For democratically accountable policymakers who are sensitive and often averse to risk, a course of action that has shown some level of past success, as tentative, as short-term as it might be, generally is seen as the best indicator of future success, and thus becomes very difficult to argue against. While the Annapolis process languished as we came toward the end of 2008, and Israel and Hamas inched closer and closer to conflict in Gaza, it seemed like the only good news coming out of the Israeli-Palestinian situation on Capitol Hill was that the U.S. and the EU train and equip programs for Palestinian security forces were contributing to safer West Bank streets and to a reduced terrorist threat. Under those circumstances, momentum gathered in Congress and in the administration, including the new Obama administration, for further appropriations to continue and to expand these train and equip programs. Which leads me to the second challenge that I want to address, and that is inertia. Each of the three cases Yazid describes has its own established patterns. Much of the dysfunction that attends the Palestinian situation goes back 15, 16 years to Oslo. There's a tangled web of stakeholders, each of whom seeks a part in preparing the ground for its version of a solution. In addition to the Israeli-Palestinian Authority and now the de facto Hamas governments, there are many outside actors. You've got the U.S. and the EU, but you also have Arab states, the Ad Hoc Liaison Committee, the Quartet representative, several different UN agencies with presences in the region, other international organizations, contractors, advocacy groups, NGOs, the list goes on. Effective coordination among these actors on across-the-board reform is pretty difficult, as each stakeholder has its own entrenched interests and expectations, many of which are actually bound up with maintaining the status quo. In such an environment, as Yazid acknowledges in his paper, the temptation's quite high to bypass bureaucratic coordination mechanisms, focus on an immediate goal, often by resort to ad hoc means. He also, there was reference earlier to the notion of everybody getting their part, and the feeling that you needed to be involved, whether it was the Canadians or whether it was the Germans, and having the conference and showing leadership on that. And I think that that's another symptom of this. Inertia can also be found within the mechanisms of each of these governments or organizations. In the case of the U.S. government on Israeli-Palestinian issues, building consensus among actors and agencies that have a part in what's going on can be pretty problematic, particularly on strategic issues with major political implications, such as the role of Hamas and potential Palestinian unity, the conduct of final status negotiations and core issues such as refugees, Jerusalem, borders, you name it. Plus, progress on the high-profile issues is bound to face setbacks and delay. Witness the last few months here. We had the stalemate over settlements, the stalemate over gradual normalization between relations with the Arab states and Israel, and now we've had this Goldstone controversy. These things tend to come up. They tend to be a natural feature of the landscape. Existing programs whose continuation does not necessarily depend upon these high-profile issues, the resolution of them or where they stand, and those existing programs include the U.S. and EU train and equip programs, these can be cited as evidence of progress even when the political track seems to be stalled or failing. And this provides further incentives to keep such programs detached from the broader political issues. Well-reasoned arguments can be marshaled to contend that short-term success is likely unsustainable. Yazid points out the dangers of an approach that cherry-picks favorites among security agencies, creates stovepipes and a fiefdom mentality, and doesn't do enough to establish due process and civilian democratic control as a matter of course to build domestic legitimacy. I've seen reports of plans. I was actually out in the region this August and meeting with some of these stakeholders and hearing about a lot of their plans to enact more comprehensive reform, both on the U.S. side and on the European side. That includes funding and training for the PA judiciary and broader criminal justice sector. It also includes the idea of consolidation of these six existing security branches into three branches, which is how it's supposed to be under the roadmap, and that is accountable to civilian democratic control under the Ministry of Interior. Whether such plans can be successfully overlaid on top of the existing train and equip program seems to be a huge dilemma, and whether that can be done in a coordinated manner. And what effect that will have on prospects for reversing what Yazid refers to as the bifurcation of the security sectors, or the reintegration of security forces from the West Bank and from Gaza, that's even a murkier question. Given the challenges that I've enunciated, it's hard not to conclude that adjusting the focus for policymakers on security assistance to a more long-term integrated approach will require strong leaders willing to counter this historical and institutional inertia and to accept the political risks that follow from asserting and educating stakeholders across the board that short-term success might not always be the best guide to sustainable positive outcomes. To the extent that Yazid's paper helps stake out this argument for leaders attuned to the debate on security sector reform in the Middle East, it's likely to be a useful primer in concert with complementary and competing views for some time to come. Thanks.
Thank you very much to all of you. Before I open it up to everybody, and please, when you speak, identify yourself for the benefit of our speakers. First of all, I need to mention something that I did not mention before, that Yazid's paper, in addition to being a very solid contribution in and of itself, also gets the prize for the best title of any of the papers that we publish. We usually get these great papers with totally wooden titles and say, what are we going to do with a title that goes, that in the original comes about this long? We never had to worry about that one, and that was a great pleasure because it does not happen very often. I would also like to take advantage of the prerogative of the chair and ask the first question. And while I do agree essentially with all three of you, because you are all converging on very much in the same body of criticism essentially about what has been done. I was listening to you talk about a more comprehensive approach, which in theory I totally agree with, and then thinking about the reality of those countries politically, of what they are, and how divided they are, and so on. And it seems to me that we are very much in a chicken and egg problem here, facing a chicken and egg problem, because essentially the kind of more comprehensive security sector reform approach that you all clearly think would be desirable, and I don't disagree with that, is probably one that is not possible unless you already have a reasonably cohesive and democratic system at the center to begin with. So that in a sense, the question becomes, well, is it possible to build that more cohesive and democratic system through security sector reform? Or is there, which one comes first, essentially, or the two be tied together? I will not ask for an immediate answer. I'm going to take two questions from the floor, and then we'll turn it over to the speakers. And also, you can pick up, reply to each other as we go along. So the floor is open. There are two microphones back there. The lady, it's coming from that side. And can you please identify yourself?
Hi, I'm Dorothy Shea from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. It just so happens that I visited two of the countries that you looked at, Yemen and Lebanon, with a particular focus of security assistance. It's something our committee is looking at, so I take on board the constructive criticism that you offer today. I did want to offer one comment and then a question. The comment is, I think there was a little bit of unfairness in characterizing the approach of the U.S. government as being single-mindedly on the security side. I think there is an awareness And we hear it in the rhetoric from the administration, talking about soft power, for example, that focusing solely on security assistance is not the answer. But I do think if you look at the trend line, there is an increasing percentage of security assistance in our overall foreign assistance levels. The irony, though, is that a lot of the security assistance that the military is carrying out actually is very much akin to what used to be called development assistance. The military is engaged in a lot of economic development work in this part of the world. And I would like to hear the views of the panelists about the pros and cons of that kind of approach. And another question is how we as a government can ensure that the counterterrorism assistance that we are providing is being used for the purposes for which we're giving it. And I think the case study of Yemen comes to mind, where there is fighting up in the north against the al-Houthi tribe, whereas U.S. government provided assistance was intended to fight al-Qaeda. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Bill Reed. I'm from the Black Press International. My question is, what should be done about and with the Goldstone Report?
Okay. Well, that's takes you out of the field a bit, but absolutely. Is it you want to start?
I guess I should tackle them in order. I mean, I'm not sure I can fit Goldstone into this discussion here, really, because unless we tackle the question of Hamas's use of violence and whether or not, you know, that ties to Goldstone and it ties to Hamas's security sector, I guess, but I don't really think I can respond to that. On the first issue, I mean, I was struck as I got into this last year that U.S. practice on the ground was starting to shift in interesting ways. I mean, I'd previously written about approaches to security sector reform in the Arab world, and I'd started by looking at U.S. and EU approaches to the Middle East, the Arab Middle East, and then vice versa. And at that point, U.S. thinking was still very narrowly confined within the restructuring approach. You know, we come in, we restructure armed forces or security sectors, as in Iraq, for instance, which was a coercive restructuring. Or elsewhere, we're into the business of putting boots on the ground, operational capacity, end of story. We just aren't interested in everything else. And that was reflected in Palestine, let's say, 2005 onwards, that the first time a security coordinator was appointed, General Ward, he kept his cards so close to his chest that even his other partners within the EU didn't know what he was doing. And that was very striking. And the first time Nicole and I met in Jerusalem, in fact, we were both trying to get more information out of each other because we, you know, the British would talk to us, but the Americans wouldn't, or at least they wouldn't to me. And so there has been, when I went back last year, I was very impressed with the degree of openness. The U.S. mission has now become far more accessible. It understands it needs to get its message across. Of course, it sometimes runs into trouble doing so because, you know, General Dayton's talk in Washington last May dismayed a lot of his Palestinian counterparts who thought he was painting them to be collaborators with Israeli occupation, in effect. So maybe too much openness. But there's much better coordination liaison between the European mission, who focus exclusively on civilian policing, and the United States security coordinator, who focuses only on the men, the backup men with the heavier guns. So there have been improvements, and that reflects a much greater awareness, or at least a tolerance of the other bits of the sector: civilian policing, criminal justice, oversight, reform, European preferences, that sort of thing. There's a lot more of that. And I think the points that Nicole made earlier about how finally some of the reform discourse is making its way as far as Field Manual 3-07, October 2008, for the first time you have, you know, an army field manual which devotes an entire chapter to security reform and restructuring. Now, that is important. Of course, I think we're still away from when all that trickles down into real practice on the ground. But these are certainly positive developments, and I do note them in the paper. However, I think there's a certain time lag, at least, if not an actual cognitive and operational gap between, say, the discourse of soft power at the level of the administration and the White House, the people who implement this on the ground, as far as I have been, I'm aware, are pretty much the same people doing pretty much the same things as ever. It's just that it's packaged somewhat differently. Now, that's not totally insignificant, but I'm just saying that we don't see a total change either yet. And given what Jim said about, you know, that there are lots of events happening on the ground, and so, for instance, General Dayton, who I think is a very decent, well-intentioned man, is nonetheless now trying to patch holes and fix the damage done since May because he's lost most of his direct access to field commanders throughout the West Bank that he and his staff had until May, where his deputies could go to every Palestinian area commander directly and talk to him and meet his troops. They've lost all that now. So it's not easy. However, I still think that there is the bigger, broader question of what the purpose is in our awareness of how to bring this all about. And I won't say much longer because I think we'll come back to it, but it touches on Marina's question. What can outside actors really do? And I think this is an extraordinarily difficult problem, not just because these societies and states aren't particularly cohesive. I frankly regard this as just another example of what Western governments or all sort of welfare governments have been doing for the past 50, 60 years, if not much longer, which is social engineering. This is all about trying to bring about particular outcomes by using the tools available to the state. Job generation, housing, whatever. Governments in the UK or the US have been doing this for decades, trying to bring about things like reducing poverty gaps or whatever it is, or increasing, decreasing segregation, social objectives. And in a sense, what we're doing there is the same. We are trying to promote effective security sectors, professional, but that also obey the law and obey democratic government. And these are very difficult processes. I frankly don't think that we're going to be much more successful doing this overseas than we are doing these things at home. I don't think it's not just about cohesive or non-cohesive states. You try doing any of these things in the US or in the UK. This is social engineering. Social engineering is difficult, crude, lengthy, protracted, and half the time, if not much more than half the time, produces results other than the ones you intend. So I guess I'd follow more the no harm principle. Try, if you can, to avoid doing harm if you have to be involved. I could say more, but I'd rather leave that for later.
Nicole?
I'm really not familiar with where the military is engaged in development work in this region. I mean, in general, I don't find it very persuasive. I haven't been in the region in a year, so in that region in a year. So I can't talk about soft power and the relative balance between security assistance and other kinds of assistance and politicals, relations and so on and so forth. I mean, but certainly what I saw in Afghanistan last December when I was there for a while didn't, we hadn't had a shift in administration. We weren't thinking about soft power, but it was going to be a long stretch before we got there. We don't see it in Africa where I spend a lot of time either. We see people who are looking to find al-Qaeda under every rock, frankly, in places where al-Qaeda is not under the rocks, or if they are, there's, a half a person or something. I would like to see it, but I haven't seen very much. Now, how do you ensure that counterterrorism assistance is being used for the purposes intended? It depends on who you give it to. I mean, I think that's the case in Yemen very, very clearly. And it's the case in Pakistan and other places. I mean, when you give it to governments that have their own agendas and their own agendas are so diametrically opposed to your own agenda, you've got to expect that there's going to be difficulties and it's not going to go where you want it to go. Because when you give the money to them, by and large, they're going to use it for what they want to use it for. So I think a lot of it has to do with whom you give it to. And unfortunately for the U.S., the people they want to give it to are not the people that are going to use it in the way that they want it used. So it's a dilemma. I don't really know. In regard to the openness of the security coordinator, the U.S. security coordinator for Palestine, I think that some of that is a result of very, very focused U.K. support because the UK very clearly and in some ways very cleverly by hand-picking the people that they put in various kinds of advisory places in the USSC's operation, really did play an important role in explaining to the USSC that there is a justice system and that you have to be concerned about it and that you can't just proceed blindly down a military path. Now, I mean, that's not the only reason, obviously, but I think that one has to look at sort of the dynamics of the relationship amongst different donors. If Dayton's been proven to be more open about it, and when I was last there, I did see some of that also, then that's good. That's good. But I have to say it's still very much within a militarized kind of context. So I don't know. It's just very much that way.
It was interesting that, Nicole, that you mentioned the UK's role in this because when I was in the region in August, I met with somebody from DFID, and she explained to me the fact that the UK funding structure in the region is a little bit different from the traditional sort of U.S. appropriation into different baskets approach. Mm-hmm. And the U.K. actually has what's called the conflict prevention pool. And they have, you know, a few million pounds that is administered and the control is devolved to the local level, which I found interesting as a contrast to, most sort of classical situations where it's centralized. You have an appropriation from a central government and it goes to a department, the State Department's budget, let's say, or the Defense Department's budget, and it's expended for that purpose. Whereas people from DFID, from the Foreign Office, and from the Ministry of Defense meet jointly to determine where those resources will be going, and several of those who are on the USSC team, it's kind of the USSC, as General Dayton likes to say often, is a misnomer because it's not solely a US thing. They have folks from the UK as well as Canadians, and I believe one member is a Turkish military officer, mainly for the reason that, well, one of the main reasons is that the U.S. officials can't actually go on a regular basis into the West Bank because of regulations having to do with mission essential travel and safety and so forth. But the U.K. allocates a large part of their conflict prevention funds to those people who have either been embedded within the Interior Ministry or are otherwise working on this issue. Speaking to Marina's question. I think that this is the debate. There are a lot of reasonable people who disagree on this and say, yeah, let's get to the point where we can have a receptive environment for more comprehensive security sector reform. Let's start with this. And I've spoken with several actors both within the U.S. government and without who say that that's the strategy that needs to be followed. As it's fleshed out, I mean, it seems as though it's interesting because the U.S. actually began its first sort of rule of law, the USSC began its first rule of law program in Jenin. I guess while he was still National Security Advisor, Mr. Hadley basically said, well, let's get some of this going. And I guess our current National Security Advisor, who was an envoy at the time in the region, General Jones, said the same thing. Let's get something going. And so now you have this sort of discourse between the EU, who is more intent on trying to at least keep up the appearances, if not actually the substance of doing something more across the board, more systematic, getting it right before just simply going and doing something. And then the US saying, well, but let's start with this and then maybe we can find lessons. And as Dayton often likes to say, he's an artilleryman, adjust fire as need be. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Very quickly, yeah, because I want to take a couple more questions and we are going to finish.
Yeah, yeah,
on time.
The UK conflict prevention pool, nice idea. I've done a couple of reviews of their work on security sector reform. It's not everything that it seems, plus the financial crisis has really eviscerated it. So,
okay, very good. Yeah, Emil? And I'll only take two questions this time.
Thank you.
Quick.
Yeah, okay. Emil Okeyem, The National. Based on my experience working on Lebanon security sector reform, I think we're missing a big part in the discussion here, which is actually the recipient side and the capability of the recipient to actually explain what it needs and so on. I mean, first, you're talking about security reform. They hate that word there. They talk about defense modernization, security modernization. The reform element is completely absent. Then, Yazid, you said donor countries love to give cars. Well, military officers love toys. I mean, the first time when Lebanese defense officials were told that the Americans were about to give them money and materials, they went and they asked for attack helicopters. That was the first request. It's sometimes completely divorced from the reality. And the problem is how the lack of capacity on the recipient side. You don't have civilian staff at the Ministry of Defense. You don't have civilian staff in Parliament. Actually, members of Parliament don't know the size of the budget. They don't know the size of the military. My problem here is ascribing too much importance to the donor side and the dysfunctioning and the lack of success of those initiatives, when actually on the recipient side, it's the lack of security strategy, military doctrine, defense doctrine, procurement policies, training policies is so obvious, and this continues to remain the main element. The donor problem exacerbates the outcome. I fully agree with you, but then in other situations, I mean, you complain that too much is focused on capabilities. Well, it's when you had the Nahal Bared experience, then actually the U.S. Military and the Lebanese military got their act together and worked on a very specific problem, which was counterterrorism, and this explains why so much is focused on counterterrorism. My point is, I think you minimize, or at least in your discussion here, you minimize too much the failings of the recipient side.
Okay, Paul, very briefly.
I'm Paul Salem, director of the Middle East Center in Beirut. I had the pleasure of hosting Yazid when he was in Beirut. Two quick questions. One, Yazid.
One. One.
Not one of two parts, huh? Well, then I'll skip to the second one. About the nexus between, you know, the politics and the military. You very much make the point, which is obviously very true, especially in the cases that you're taking, Yemen, Palestine, and Lebanon, the degree to which internal divisions, communal and otherwise, dominate the political scene. But I wanted to ask you just to, you know, get your reflections, having worked close to these militaries and in maybe some other cases that you've worked on, putting aside the fact that there's some obvious political issues that you touch on, I have a sense that in some of these countries, the existence of a military, which is a large institution in these states, is a place, well, first of all, that there is a certain degree of low-grade professionalism and esprit de corps that does exist regardless of other things that take place. And that in some cases, the military, which is a very large institution, is a place where groups sometimes are able to coexist, accommodate each other, share aspects of command. And so I know this is the case to some degree in Lebanon. It's also, in some cases, an institution which is acknowledged to provide a common good that nobody wants to utterly destroy. Also reflecting on the fact that once you lose the military, you've lost the state. And when, you know, in the Palestinian case, once the security branches of the different parties, as it were, broke in two, there was no political unity to speak of. In Iraq, when you lost the army, there was no such thing. In Lebanon, in the mid-70s, when you lost the army, there was nothing left. In Lebanon today, almost all that's left is the army that's keeping this afloat. So I was asking you to reflect on the very limited other side of sort of the existence of some professionalism or some esprit, some semblance of unity that a military can provide, even if it's not the most reformed or professional.
Okay, thank you. I think we are good. I apologize to people who had other questions, but we are really running out of time, so we are going to turn to the reply. It's an iron rule that we try to finish on time. Sorry about that.
Well, Paul, thanks for introducing yourself, because I was planning actually to end by acknowledging Paul Salem's role in hosting me in Beirut and the support he gave me, keeping me well-fed indeed and amused. You ask an enormous question, so I'm not going to try and answer it. But let me first respond to Emil's point. I mean, absolutely. There are all sorts of problems on recipient sides, and I did try to use the introductory sections when I discussed each country in the paper to give a sense of what those local problems were. But the purpose of the paper was to focus on what the US and the EU are doing. It was consciously, this ultimately wasn't in the title, but it was specifically intended to study US and EU approaches. I certainly don't take the view that it's all the US or EU's fault, I've been trying to emphasize this, do I believe that the US and the EU hold all the answers, even if they wanted to do everything right and put all their money in and da da da. I really have very grave doubts about whether, in fact, they could produce what the locals don't want to produce. I mean, there's no question in my mind. But I do think that, again, the Jordanian example is interesting precisely because local actors can make different choices. And that tends to reinforce what you're saying, which is that local actors have the responsibility to make choices. They can make more effective and less effective choices. In the Palestinian case, I did refer to what the Fayyad government did for itself. And although the EU had been pushing since at least 2004, if not earlier, for a reduction in the number of security force personnel, this only actually came about finally when Fayyad had the authority and the power to do so. And he did so for his own reasons as much as anyone else's. So, I mean, there's no question, I think, about sort of trying to lay the burden of responsibility too much on one side or the other. I think it's far more interesting to ask ourselves, when is it that local actors do things right, let's say, with, you know, qualifying the word right? What persuades them to do certain things as opposed to others? Can outside actors help nudge them in one direction or another? And I'm suggesting that in these three cases, the outside actors have done some good stuff, have nudged occasionally in the right direction, but have also done other things that have been problematic. And I'll give you one glaring example of this, is the intelligence sector in Palestine, where you have two main intelligence agencies in the West Bank, the Preventive Security Apparatus and General Intelligence, Mukhabarat. And these have been in a close working relationship with the CIA and with the British SIS since 1994-96. There's always been a relationship at a time when both the UK, the EU, and the US were not committed to security sector construction, let alone reform, from day one. The relationship with intelligence has continued all the way through. The one sector that no one discusses in Palestine today is the intelligence bit, the intelligence part of the sector. The two main intelligence agencies are the ones that are being accused by Human Rights Watch and others of human rights abuses in the West Bank under the Fayyad government. Dayton has been taken great pains to insist that these are not the forces he deals with and trains, which is technically correct and fair. The point is there's this big black hole no one talks about, no one addresses, which are the two intelligence agencies that aren't under proper oversight, that do meet weekly with the prime minister, who I think is a very good man. Nonetheless, what they do is beyond the rule of law. They do not enforce court decisions that instruct them to release prisoners. They don't get warrants, etc., proper warrants. They conduct the arrests. They hold people. They keep them in detention, or else they hand them over to military intelligence, which supposedly doesn't even exist. And moreover, these two agencies have and continue, apparently, according to my information, very recent information from people who are very plugged in, continue to receive cash in suitcases from the CIA and apparently a little bit, until the financial crisis, from the British. So that, I think, is a glaring example of it's not, I don't mean that the fault is entirely the CIA's. I'm just trying to point out how local actors will pursue their agendas and they will make use of what opportunities and resources are come their way. And I'll wrap up my comments with trying to touch on what Paul said, which is that I don't think that the military or the other parts of the security sector, i.e. police forces, gendarmerie, intelligence, etc., I mean, they all have a certain esprit de corps. They all develop a certain corporate identity and, to some extent, in some cases, professional pride. And I do think that there have been positive things happening here and there. I mean, what Dayton has done with the National Security Forces, as they're called in Palestine, the green uniform people, the Palestinians regard them as their army to be, I think is very impressive. They have become far more professional, and I don't just mean that they look smart in nice, well, you know, well-laundered uniforms. They behave in a far more professional way. They've been relieved of most of the old commanders that they used to have. And I was actually surprised by just how much of a new spirit there was when I visited them. And I did quite a lot of intensive visiting last year. Good stuff can be done. I don't think that the sort of labeling the armed forces versus the police versus the others in and of itself tells us much. The functions and roles of each one of these agencies will vary from country to country. In Yemen, for instance, the army is used basically to deal with unemployment and to deal with tribes that get upset in Ma'rib or somewhere else. And what you do is you just put 1,000 of their young men on the army payroll. They stay at home, but you now have a new brigade in Ma'rib. That doesn't make it professional. The Central Security Force is the professional one in Yemen, and that's to do with counterterrorism, for instance. In Jordan, it's something quite different. So I don't think we can ascribe any necessary connection between these different things. I do want to emphasize, though, that while sort of a corporate identity and professionalism are important things, none of these are a guarantee, as Huntington started arguing back in the 50s, that the military will then detach themselves either from politics or, say, from illicit commercial activity or whatever else. There is no necessary connection between training them and making them more professional. They can fall apart just as easily. And the irony is that if you're to look at the Palestinian situation, even today, under Fayyad, there are as many separate security agencies and branches as there were under Yasser Arafat, which was when everyone got upset. In Gaza, on the other hand, Hamas has consolidated the proliferation of security agencies into three. I don't like their model, but I'm just pointing out that in terms of professionalism, they actually do a far better job of getting to a crisis situation in a street, of keeping guns off the street, in disarming clans and gangs, than the Fatah-dominated security forces ever did. Does that mean they're the model we want to follow? Well, I wouldn't want to. But I'm just pointing out that the professionalism, consolidation, organizational aspects are just one facet, and we shouldn't get overhooked on them. I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you. Any final comments?
I'll leave the last word with Yazid.
Okay.
No, same
okay.
Here.
Well, then, again, my apologies to people whose questions I did not take, but please help me thank the speakers for a very interesting presentation.